Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to talk about astronomy. So if you have a question about the planets, the stars, black holes, dark matter, etc., give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. A couple people already have done that, and you're welcome to join the queue. But the number is 800-348-2551. Astronomers Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Welcome back to the Cosmic Ballet, boys and girls. Actually, it's more like modern dance. We have two astronomers in the studio today, and they will talk about some far-out things, man. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world is here. Bob Berman is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question about the heavens, call now. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But the number again is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. Doing really great.
Some exciting pictures to talk about from the web, and we'll do that in a minute right after we introduce Bob Berman. Bob, how are you?
Everything's great. Thanks.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Did you guys see the picture of Neptune with the rings from the web?
Love it. Love it.
Beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Now, again, this is not invisible light, right? This is in infrared?
Yeah, because you don't even see it. Invisible light, you don't see the rings.
Ah. And when did we discover that there, in fact, were rings? When I was a kid, Neptune was not pictured with rings.
No, it's true. And I don't know the exact year.
Well, it was back when the Voyagers flew by. We got our first look up close at Neptune, and I believe we got a glimpse of the rings back then.
And so we can observe that all the gas giants have some sort of a ring?
Mm-hmm. Yep, we've seen it all. So sometimes we have to travel there, but now with James Webb, we might even be able to catch a glimpse of all of them just from that telescope.
I saw a picture, and I'm not sure if this was a from a satellite going by, but I saw a very cool picture of Venus today. I don't know. Did you see that?
I didn't catch the one of Venus, but there's been a bunch of spacecrafts that are traveling by Venus on flybys. We've got missions that are kind of circling in towards Venus to orbit, so it doesn't surprise me that we're getting some cool pictures back.
Have we heard anything since it was first postulated that there could be life seated in the clouds of Venus?
Mm. I'm thinking that they're kind of, you know...
Backing away
a little bit. You know, it's not that this molecule isn't in the atmosphere.
Right.
I think it was phosphine or something like that. But it's very likely that if it's there, it's not caused by microbial life in the atmosphere. It's caused by some chemical processes. And we just don't understand the atmosphere well enough to say for sure it's got to be microbes.
That's interesting. Bob, you know, the first... Well, the Russians sent a probe to Venus first,
yeah, Venera,
right?
Yeah, the Venera. It lasted 23 minutes.
It got crushed by the atmosphere.
Exactly, yes. The atmosphere is about 90 times thicker than ours, and the temperature is 850 degrees day and night. Doesn't even cool off at night.
Have we been there since? That was in the 60s, wasn't it? 70s? Early 70s?
Yeah, I want to say early 70s, yes. I believe it was.
We've sent orbiters. It's just not a place you want to mess with. It's just the most brutal place in the known universe.
Well, this picture that I saw, I think it was on Twitter. I'm not sure who sent it out, but it was blue. So that's a false color, right?
Oh,
is it actually blue?
No, it's not blue.
What color is it?
Well, the clouds are pretty white. I mean, it's so bright that it stimulates the cone-shaped cells in our eyes so that we can see it in true color when we see Venus in the sky. And this is one of those cases that what you see is what you get. It really is that color.
All right, let's go to a couple of emails here. The number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question about astronomy or you want to make a comment. This is from Mike. Are the charged particles that form the aurora borealis absorbed entirely in the upper atmosphere, or do some continue on to reach the Earth's surface?
Well, it's not charged particles that reach the surface so much as forms of light, the forms that we don't see. Unfortunately, when there are strong solar storms caused by extremely explosive events on the sun, what it really does is creates enough electricity in the upper atmosphere, and we're talking about heavy duty, far outweighing anything like lightning. And that, of course, makes atoms, mostly oxygen, incidentally, jump to higher orbits. And then when the electrons go back to where they like to be, because they don't like to be in those higher orbits at all, they give off light at specific places, such as 5009 angstroms. You can always tell how old I am because I keep using angstroms, because when I was in school, that's what we used. Astronomers used angstroms. Physicists used nanometers. And there was like ongoing battle. Now everybody uses nanometers, but okay. So 5,000 and a little over 5,000 angstroms, and that gives off the greenish light that's so characteristic.
You know, we had a fairly sizable solar event last month, I think. I got very excited. I said, this is our chance. Not a thing could be seen.
Yeah.
I guess you have to travel further north to really have a good bet on that.
Yeah, for the most part, you do. Sometimes, when I was back in Rochester, we could see them a little bit because you're looking over Lake Ontario, so you have such a dark sky until you get to the cities in Canada. So it was a little easier to see from there. But here, we have so much light glow towards the north that it's kind of tricky to view from where we are.
Of course, where Bob goes, it's always good viewing, and I'm sure you're going to be going again to the north
country.
Yeah,
once a year. We've been doing this 30 years. We take groups up to our secret places in Alaska. And the reason we go there is simply because if you go to Scandinavia, yes, there's auroras there, but it's cloudy too much of the time. The northern Atlantic is a really cloudy place. And we've had people who've come back from a week there, and it was overcast every night. So you're not going to see auroras that way. So we have places that are dark and usually clear and get auroras 2 out of 3 nights. And I have to say, in the 30 years we've gone, we've never had a group that did not see fabulous all-sky auroras. So
now, when you take your tours, do you make everybody sign a disclaimer saying, you know, if we don't see any auroras, Bob Berman is not held liable?
No, I'll just run away. They won't find me.
Okay, in Alaska. Good plan. And so when is the next one?
Oh, coming up this February, people could just easiest way is just remember my name, Bob Berman Tours, and it'll take you to where they are, the dates, and all the rest of
What's
it.
What's your name again?
Bob Berman.
No, that's right. All right, this email from James. What if there were no objects in space to warp space-time? What would be left? Dark energy only? What could happen to the universe? Valerie, what do you think?
Yeah, well, anything that has mass has the ability to warp space-time. So if we didn't have any massive objects, there literally wouldn't be anything. So I suppose the universe would just be perpetuated with some sort of energy that we don't fully understand. We have all of this dark energy and even the dark matter, right? I mean, I guess that technically is a massive object because it's warping space-time and affecting gravity. But yeah, it would just kind of be filled, this vacuum would be filled with an energy in the ether, and we still don't fully understand exactly what it is. So it's hard to describe, you know, what the universe might look like. But there wouldn't be anything to see, that's for sure.
You know, you're a PhD and you're very smart, but if you don't know what it is, are you 100% sure that it is?
Well, I guess not, if you put it that way. I mean, we have all of this evidence, though, that there is this dark energy affecting our universe. I mean, that's what causes the expansion of the universe. There's nothing else that we can physically see that could be doing this. So we just postulate that there must be some energy there doing it. But exactly what that energy is, we still don't know.
Yeah, it's really giving a name to an effect.
Yeah, exactly.
The effect is like an anti-gravity effect that the universe is blowing itself apart. And so we give a name to it. We say, oh, it's caused by, but you might as well just say they're the same thing. The effect and the word for it is the same thing. And dark matter, not too dissimilar. But when you were saying warping of space, we have to differentiate between the definite warpings that we see, that like when we get to any kind of massive object, neutron star, galaxy, massive galaxy, black hole, yes, we see the light being distorted from objects further away as they're trying to pass through that vicinity on their way to us. But then there's the issue of the overall shape of the universe. Sure. And this is where a team from Berkeley, led by Shirley Ho 10 years ago, made that astonishing discovery that on the largest scale, there is no warping of the universe.
So it's a flat topology.
A flat topology. And that tells us something about what's over the horizon beyond the observable universe to the part we can't see. It tells us that that part must be huge. Because if what we could see is most of what there is, there wouldn't be this flat topology. So we know that the universe must keep going and be at least thousands of times larger than the part that we see. And it could even be, I spoke to her personally about it, and she said it doesn't rule out an infinite universe.
All right. You know what? It's early, and yet I'm already perplexed. So let's take a break. We'll take a deep breath. It's only just begun. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up at 800-348-2551. Fox Pop on WAMC. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson from SUNY Oneonta and Bob Berman from somewhere in the cosmos. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's grab a call here. Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hello.
What are the estimates lately as to how far away some of the planets might be that might be able to sustain human life?
Yeah, that's a good question. So some are really close and some are relatively far. I mean, we're still keeping an eye on Proxima Centauri. It's got a planet in the habitable zone. Probably not going to have human life on it. It's got a lot of radiation from the star. But there are planets that are, you know, just a few hundred light years away, which is close on galactic scales, that might be Earth-like and have a much higher probability of some sort of life on them. So we're looking mostly at things that are relatively nearby.
A few hundred light years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we've all heard of some of the greater minds, I guess, saying that due to population and our use of resources and other factors, we're going to need to find another planet to relocate to.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how practical this is.
Not at all.
A few years ago, Bob, I called you. Right. A few years I called you and I asked you how far it might be to find another planet that has intelligent life on it already. And you speculated about 20 light years away. It's just, you picked as an example, you proposed that idea. And the speed of transportation would be 1% of the speed of light. And we calculated that would take 2,000 years to get to.
Well, the problem with
a few hundred.
Yeah, is that I'm just making these things up. But that was the problem then, and it would be again now, because, you know, we don't know. I mean, Proxima Centauri, that Valerie just mentioned, is a little closer than 4.4 light years. That if the planet there could sustain life, that's pretty close. I think at our fastest rockets, we could probably get there in 60,000 years.
Nice.
Not too bad.
No, very good.
Uh-huh.
Well, Richard, thank you very much for the call, and let's go to David in Poughkeepsie. David, you're on.
Hi, I'm wondering how the guests interpret things the Webb telescope is seeing and how that affects the Big Bang theory.
All right. Valerie.
Yeah, there's been some speculation out there that, you know, James Webb is disproving the Big Bang, which is totally not true. But people are looking at some of those images, like the really deep sky images with all those galaxies, and we're looking at redshifts and trying to understand the distances to these galaxies, and do they match up with our idea of the universe being around 14 billion years old? And the answer is that, you know, everything kind of jives right now. Everything looks pretty good. You know, the farthest galaxies we've seen with James Webb, I think, are 13.6, 13.8 billion years old, so or billion light years away. So everything kind of matches up to what we're seeing. There are some discrepancies when we compare it to things like distances calculated with supernova explosions, but James Webb is not, you know, changing our mindset of the Big Bang. It's just allowing us to study objects that are closer to the Big Bang and really hone in on that distance and the age of our universe.
Bob.
Exactly. The thing about James Webb is that, again, you have to make assumptions, and the Big Bang, if we were starting from scratch and you had a theory that caused you to end up with a Big Bang, that is a universe popping out of nothingness, you'd say, well, we have to reject that theory. That's impossible. You can't get anything from nothing. So that's enough to reject it. The Big Bang couldn't have happened because you can't get a whole universe from nothing, true nothingness, which is what the Big Bang really comes down to. And if you postulate an antecedent condition that produced the universe, well, then that's still, you still haven't answered it. So it's no answer. You're getting no answer. But as Valerie correctly said, if you extrapolate in reverse that all the galaxies speeding away from each other, you just trace them backward. Everything was at one place at one time. Mm-hmm. Plus, you look at the ratio between hydrogen, helium, and lithium. That's just what you'd expect from a Big Bang. You look at the cosmic microwave background. That's exactly what you'd expect if there was a Big Bang that happened. And if there was inflation that happened after that, then that makes sense. So the bottom line is the Big Bang had to have happened, given all the evidence. And the Big Bang could not have happened because you can't get a universe from nothing. So if you want to speak the truth, it's impossible. Also, it's inescapable.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, now stop that. you mentioned Dr. Ho as opposed to Dr. Who and Dr. No, and you said that the topology of the universe is flat, thus possibly indicating that it is infinite. If it is infinite, can it have had a beginning?
That's excellent. You can't really get to any. You can't get to infinity by starting at a finite spot. You know, this is basic math. So maybe there were separate Big Bangs, and the Big Bang that we talk about, we say the Big Bang, is just like a local event in the hood. Mm-hmm. This is just something that's just here. But there are other areas in the universe, maybe beyond the observable universe boundary, where there were other Big Bangs happening at different points. So that's possible.
Okay. Well, Valerie, give me your physics answer on this one. If dark matter exists and it has this propulsive effect, do we need to have had a Big Bang?
Well, I think you're referring to dark energy.
Dark energy, pardon me, yes.
Yeah. So the Big Bang kind of helps explain in part why the universe would be expanding. It doesn't necessarily explain what dark energy is and why it's there, but it helps get the universe going, right? If there was no Big Bang and the universe was just here and it had been here forever, then we wouldn't necessarily observe any motion other than what gravity would do. You know, if you've got two galaxies next to each other, they'll pull each other towards because of gravity. But we see this mysterious repulsive force that we cannot physically explain. And one way to get that going and create it is to have some sort of bang in the beginning, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to our phone lines. 800-348-2551 is the number. David is in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Yes, I wanted to ask Bob and Valerie how their scientific knowledge has affected their spiritual, personal relationship to God in the universe.
Great question, David. Now, in fairness, if neither one of these wants to answer it, that's okay with me, but we'll throw it out there.
May I go first?
Yes, you may, and thank you for asking.
When I was 20, somebody gave me a book called The Way of Zen by Alan Watts, and it said that you actually can know the truth of the universe, but it's a different state of consciousness. You can't be in your thinking mind. In fact, you can't use logic. You have to be empty of thoughts.
No, mission accomplished.
And if you can get to that state, you can actually see the truth. what's really going on, what you would call spiritual or the essence of God or the essence or in what they sometimes call realization or the enlightenment experience, what have you. And I thought, well, that's great. Okay, I'll stop my mind from thinking. And for a whole month, I did every time a thought would come, which was, of course, all the time, I would try and try and try. And sometimes I'd try so hard my body would shake with the effort. And I don't have to tell you, it was futile.
Yeah.
Nothing worked. And then one evening when I was studying for an exam in college, I was in my junior year of college, and not thinking about Eastern religion at all, suddenly something I read in a textbook, suddenly it triggered it. Everything became this blue-white light, and I felt like this weight that had been on my shoulders all my life, 1,000 pounds that I didn't even know was there, was suddenly lifted. And the next thing I knew, I was the universe. Now, that doesn't make sense then, and it doesn't make sense now. You had to have been there because the experience was ineffable, which is just what the word means. You can't put it into words. I can't put it into words myself, but it was blissful. It was certain. It was not like something new. It was like revisiting something from ancient times that I had lost a million years ago, but I recognized. It was like, it was something that was recognized right to your bones as the truth. And it was total bliss. And you know it was certain. And the bottom line, put it into words, is that everything was one. There's no such thing as death. Changed my life.
Wow. Now, this was the 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was no drugs involved.
Okay,
this was
right.
Just a test. And for 3 weeks, for the next 3 weeks, not a thought came through my head. My mind was gone for 3 weeks. And as I said, no drugs involved.
Okay.
And when my mind returned, my thinking mind returned, by the way, it started out with songs, you know, Beatles songs would run through your mind.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream.
And before I knew it, I had a mind again, and I was Bob, and I saw a separation between myself and the rest, and the exterior world, which had been gone for 3 weeks. And it felt so heavy and so unfortunate that I thought, well, that's all I cared was getting back to that place, and I wish I could give the happy news that, yes, I refound it, but I never did.
Oh my
gosh. It was that 3 weeks, and so the caller is asking, how does my scientific mind... No, the scientific mind does not give me truth, but I know from that experience that it is findable or is experienceable. But not by any form of logic.
All right, Valerie, try to top that.
Well, I can't say that I've had such a blissful experience as Bob has had, but my take on the whole thing is that I'm so curious about how things work and what's out there, and I worry less about the why. Why are we here, and what put us here, if something did put us here? Either way, whether it was by grand design or whether it was purely nature, we can still be curious and observe what's happening and try and understand it better, because it exists. It is there, whether it's purposeful or not, and I want to know more about it.
That is so interesting that you said. You're not that strictly concerned about the why. And I've always thought that the entire basis for most science, especially astronomy and everything else, is why are we here?
Mm.
Well, are we by ourselves? And why are we here? Why, you know?
Well, Ray, do you feel there's intelligence behind everything? Is nature intelligent?
Is nature intelligent?
Mm. Yes.
I don't think. I don't know.
Or is is everything just random?
Right. That's
I'm a radio
deep.
Host. I'm not used to intelligence.
What do you think, Valerie?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of a really deep question that we have to think about. Is nature controlling everything, or are we just observing what is randomly happening in nature? I don't know.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, Valerie, before you were on the show, occasionally we would have lava lamp moments where we turn the lights down, we put the lava lamp on, and put on some Quicksilver messenger service. But those days are gone. Let's go to Glenn in East Durham. Glenn, you're on.
Hi, guys. Two quick questions. For the past month and a half or so, I noticed I look to the east, I see this bright light come up, and it goes up into the sky for a while and stays there. So I'm trying to figure out, what is it? Is it a planet or is it a satellite?
It's Jupiter.
Really bright.
It's Jupiter if it's in the evening, and it's Venus if you saw it, not lately, but let's say most of the summer, and it was just before dawn. It was just before dawn, it was Venus in the east. Nowadays, it's Jupiter.
And Glenn, I got to say, you got a pair of binoculars, you can see some moons of Jupiter, mm-hmm. and it's fantastic. Valerie recommended that we get these specific astronomical binoculars, and we went out the other night. Jupiter was so bright, and you could see, I think, two moons at this time.
Sure.
Very cool. Yeah, and then the other one that's really getting us is Arcturus. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been really enjoying that one. A couple times, see it through the trees and say, oh, that's a star.
Yeah.
It almost has a red hue. Mm-hmm.
It does. It's orange. And the easier one to find is Vega, which is straight up. That's why it's easy. Just at nightfall, the star closest to straight up, it's bluish white, like a diamond. And that's Vega.
Okay. And not Vega.
Not Vega. Don't let friends say Vega.
Okay, Valerie?
I was going to say Vega, so I guess I'm not your friend anymore.
Oh, ouch. Okay, let's go grab an email or two. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Cosmology question from Karen in Latham. For several years, I've tried slogging through supposedly accessible books to help me grasp the increasingly popular idea that our universe came from nothing. Apart from any spiritual beliefs I entertain that might be getting in my way, I just can't follow their reasoning. One author claimed, nothingness is inherently unstable. Huh? I was relieved to read Bob Berman's book Beyond Biocentrism, in which he explicitly rejects that theory. I wonder if he would take a crack at explaining in layman's terms why he doesn't accept it. And that's from Karen in Latham.
The it that we're talking about is not accepting the universe popping out of nothingness.
Yeah, nothingness is inherently unstable.
If I wrote that, then I then I just made it up.
No, one author said. One author said that. You reject that in Beyond Biocentrism.
Yeah, I don't know how nothingness. First of all, it's hard to think of nothingness as having any properties. We actually, Valerie and I now both do believe that nothingness has properties because when we say the universe is expanding, the galaxies aren't actually moving. It's the empty space between them that's inflating. So somebody could reasonably say, how can nothingness or emptiness do anything, let alone get larger? And yet that's what's believed. That's where the evidence takes us, that nothingness actually can have properties. Also, we think that nothingness can contain a lot of energy. That's zero point energy. It's sometimes called vacuum energy. It's sometimes called, but the space between photons of light or particles actually seethe with tremendous power. So we have to be careful about nothingness, but being unstable, I guess in a way it's unstable because if it's inflating and some say that it may someday collapse on itself, well, that means we're not sure what it's up to or what it could do someday.
Is there nothingness at all? I mean, we have allegedly this quantum fizz that's going on all the time. So is there nothingness? I mean, can it exist?
What do you say, Valerie?
I mean, not really. We had to start from somewhere, right? There had to be some sort of energy, some sort of quantum level thing that then created our universe and all the energy and matter that we see there. And we don't understand that very beginning piece, but it's unlikely that it was physically nothing. You know, we may call it nothing because we don't understand it, but it kind of goes back to our dark matter, dark energy thing. It's just a name for something that we can't yet fully explain.
This one is from Ethan, our buddy in Truckee, California. How's the James Webb Telescope doing, and what is the furthest galaxy in light years we've observed? And that's from Ethan.
Well, it's doing pretty good. They've had a small issue with the MIRI instrument, the mid-infrared, I think it was the spectrograph portion. Long story short, well, the filter wheel that moves in front of it, or the mechanism that changes the filters, it's a little finicky right now. It's not changing appropriately, but they're kind of trying to diagnose that. The rest of the instrument, as well as all the other instrumentation on James Webb, is working just phenomenally.
Okay. And 13.8 billion light years is the answer to the other part of his question.
And that is because the redshift gets beyond what?
Yeah, beyond a certain point, you can't see a thing anymore because it's redshifted into non-visibility.
Right. You know,
let's take a break here. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson join us today. It's Astronomy. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop at WAMC.org is the email address. We'll be right back. Up jump spring. That's, you know what? It's inappropriate. Up jump fall, right? Today's the day. But you know what? We couldn't play Autumn in New York by Sarah Vaughan. It would take too long. We'd have to play the whole thing. It's Astronomy today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are here. This email from Sam. Subject heading, looking back. This is one weird show, by the way. We are already in a weird place. Here we go. If light is the fastest thing in the universe, how can we see light from closer in time to the Big Bang? In other words, since light is faster than everything else, wouldn't it have gone past where we are now and we wouldn't be able to see it? That's from Sam.
Well, it's kind of a tricky concept. So light does travel at the speed of light, 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, and that is the maximum speed that it can travel. But we are able to see light that is redshifted into what we now observe as the cosmic microwave background at microwave or radio wavelengths, and that light is just permeating throughout the whole universe, so we can kind of always see it. It's not like there's one light particle that just whizzes by and when it's gone, we don't get to see it anymore. We are getting this ambient glow continuously from the early universe. And we have to remember in the beginning, too, that space stretched faster than the speed of light. And that causes some weird time and space issues when it comes to things at the speed of light and seeing things kind of beyond the edge of the universe as well.
Bob, you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, I love that. I loved every word of it. My favorite thing about light is, of course, Valerie's using the metric system, and I come from an era of mostly because writing for Discover
right.
And astronomy for
186,000 miles per second.
186,282.38 miles per second. But here's the cool thing: if you want to think about light, it's very nearly 1 foot. In a nanosecond, in a billionth of a second. And the cool thing about that is it means that whenever you are looking at anything a certain number of feet away from you, let's say you wave hello to a friend across the street, they're 50 feet, that means you're seeing them as they were 50
right.
nanoseconds ago, 50 billionths of a second in the past. So using the foot equals nanosecond thing, you can see how much into the past you're looking, even here on Earth.
Okay, the number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, and let's see, this is from Harleen. Subject heading, is the universe conscious? Yes, because it is a self-organizing system that reacts to its environment, according to Rupert Sheldrake.
All right. Bob take it. He's the master of consciousness over here.
Well, here's the thing. It's hardly my idea. The people who started quantum theory, and we're talking about from Niels Bohr to Werner Heisenberg and all of them, eventually came to believe, because their experiments showed different results depending upon how the experiment was being observed and what information was in the minds of the people doing the experiment.
Right.
And because of that, they eventually, all of them, came to believe that what is most fundamental in the universe is consciousness. So that we used to say matter, energy, what have you, and all listeners can think of, well, what's the most basic fundamental thing that can't be derived from anything else? What's there if you took away everything else? And these guys came to believe it was consciousness, that you don't get consciousness from anything else, even though a lot of people think, well, the brain somehow makes it. No, the brain doesn't make it. The brain is involved with consciousness, but it doesn't create consciousness. So their idea was that the universe, if you were going to define it, is that it's a self-aware entity, maybe an eternal entity, but it's self-aware, yes.
Does it have free will?
Well, if you go along with Einstein, and I do, nothing has free will. Because everything is determined by nature. Everything's happening on its own.
All right. Then Sheldrake is wrong, because it's not adjusting things. It's not a self. It might be a self-regulating system, but it's just following laws. If there is no free will, then the universe cannot be fully conscious.
It's tricky. Like, did you see the lightning this morning?
Yes, I did. I was up at 4:45 watching the lightning this morning.
Great, great lightning. So, would you say that thunderstorm was exhibiting free will? Most of us would say no, but would you say it was determined or predetermined? Most of us would say no to that also. So, what's left? What's left is maybe an unfolding in the moment in an intelligent way, and maybe based on everything else that's happening in the universe, things are happening, and easily and effortlessly, and I'd say with so much intelligence behind it that we haven't even begun to poke our clumsy fingers into the beginnings of this intelligence that underlies the whole universe.
All right, let's give it to Valerie for the final word. Consciousness in the universe?
I'm just going to go with what Bob said, because he is the master of consciousness, and okay. I'm not even going
to
try.
You know what? That's a good plan. Let's go to the phones. Dominic in Schenectady. Dominic, you're on.
Yeah, I have a simple question, but it's kind of philosophical.
All right.
If you can imagine it, like, for instance, one can imagine a fairy. Is that based on reality?
I don't know if I get it. Get the question. Valerie does.
Your imagination. The imaginary world.
Well,
the
complex
world.
I think that, understanding our universe initially takes a lot of imagination, right? We can't just look at something and instantly know what it is, so we have to take the world around us and what we have learned thus far and attempt to imagine and hypothesize, what it could be that we're looking at. But we have to remember that we have to do experiments and we have to test our theories. We can't just take what our imagination gives us for granted. We have to actually study it and try and prove to ourselves that what we are seeing is indeed the truth.
Yeah, because if the question is everything is imagined has some reality to it, no, because we can take components of some area, combine them with others, like we could imagine a purple elephant. That doesn't mean there are actually purple elephants. It just means we could take aspects of some things, combine them with others, and imagine it. Mm-hmm. That doesn't give them reality.
All right. Hey, Dominic, thank you for that one. This email from Christopher. I have a friend who says he saw the moon rise one night at a particular location over the mountains. Let's call it position X. He said that a month or so later, he saw the moon set at the same location, and I say that's not possible. Who is correct? And that's from Christopher.
You're correct. It's not possible.
Right. Can't rise and set in the same position. You have to be on opposite sides of the sky to do that.
All right. Back to the phones we go, and Peter and Gilderland. Peter, you're on.
Yes, I came in late, but I heard, I think the lady, I forgot names.
Valerie.
Thank you. And because of the speed of light, the things change, but because the universe is expanding faster than the speed of light. So I'm just wondering, I heard nothing's faster than the speed of light. So how is the universe expanding faster than the speed of light, if that's what I heard?
Right. So early on, in the very beginning, when we experienced what we call inflation, it was expanding faster than the speed of light. But now it has a finite speed that is less than that, at least in our observable universe portion that we are able to see. So right now, we're not expanding faster than
that. And how do we know that at one point it was faster than it is now?
Because our current size and the theories that tell us what we should be able to observe and what the physical size of the universe should be, they don't match unless we invoke this faster-than-light expansion early on.
We could not be getting the same. That cosmic microwave background could not be. It's the same everywhere in the sky to within one part in 50,000. Mm-hmm. Now, you could not get that homogeneity. You couldn't get that evenness unless information and attributes were spread throughout the universe, all of it, faster than the universe was expanding. And right. this came about in 1979 when Alan Guth, I think he was in Princeton, postulated the inflationary universe. And that suddenly made inflation make sense and the early universe make sense. Without it, without this faster, and this would be much faster than light speed, inflation, then you can't make sense of our observations.
Peter.
So he shouldn't be saying nothing's faster than the speed of light anymore.
Right.
Yeah, well, that was.
Okay, fair enough,
Plus,
Peter.
Quantum phenomena are always faster than the
right.
speed
That's
of light.
That's a whole other...
Yeah, because if you get entangled particles, one particle that could be in the Andromeda Galaxy would know what the other particle in a lab in Cleveland... That's been observed, and it would assume particles that are complementary to the lab in Cleveland, and it wouldn't do so faster than the speed of light. It would do so instantaneously,
okay.
which means infinitely faster than the speed of light.
Let me take a time out here and stop you there. We've talked about entangled particles and the instantaneous flipping like switches. All right, you're in Cleveland. Let's say Valerie's running the experiment in Cleveland. How do we know what's going on in the Andromeda Galaxy? How do we prove it? All right, let's go back to the phones. Warren in Sharon, Connecticut. Warren, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if anyone on your panel was familiar with a writer named Gerald Schroeder. He's a physicist with his doctorate degree from MIT, and he wrote some books that I found very accessible, and he, one of them is called Genesis and the Big Bang, another one is called The Science of God, and it's not, I found it not wacky. He seemed to be quite schooled in both science and in the Hebrew text, and he seemed to be able to cogently align the text with actual science and evolution, et cetera. Any familiarity with his writings?
I'm not, and I find those attempts usually to be frustrating and not valid. I haven't read him, so it's unfair for me to comment on him. But when going back to 1950, the book Worlds in Collision with Emanuel Velikovsky,
right.
who did exactly that and tried to align the Bible with astronomy, and postulated that Jupiter expelled a comet that wandered through the sky and explained the manna from heaven that fed the fleeing Israelites, because he said carbohydrates flake off from comets. But he got so many things wrong, despite a following of millions of people. Like, comets don't give off carbohydrates. They give off hydrocarbons, which are less tasty and less nutritious.
No, I mean, that sounds like quackery to me. Agreed.
That's right. And that's why I can't comment on this guy, because it may not be quackery. And so I'm speaking without having read it, so let me stop.
All right, fair enough. Warren, thank you very much. We go to North Adams, and Michael, you're on.
Hi. My question is regarding to intergalactic or interstellar travel, and I was wondering about the feasibility of faster-than-light travel. I know right now it's just theoretical, but theoretically, what would be the possibilities to do that? Would it be, you know, using some kind of fusion reactor to power faster light travel, or how do we, you know, survive traveling through wormholes to get to places instantaneously?
No, you couldn't. It's theoretically impossible, not theoretically possible, theoretically impossible, for the simple reason that as you go faster and faster, your mass increases. And that means you have more weight that you have to try to push even faster as you're approaching the speed of light, so that just under the speed of light, you'd outweigh the universe, and the amount of energy you'd need to reach the speed of light would be infinite. So you cannot reach the speed of light. I mean, let's not worry about how it would affect human beings and their appetites and whether you'd be hungry and need more snacks. You don't get to that yet, because you couldn't do it. If you start out weighing less than a feather, you'd outweigh the universe below the speed of light, so you could never reach the speed of light.
And go ahead, Valerie.
What we can do, though, is we can invoke relativity a little bit, and as we approach the speed of light, if we can do so in a fast enough manner so that we can get there without, you know, destroying our bodies in the process, because it's the acceleration that gets you, not the actual speed that you're traveling that gets you. But we can invoke relativity, and the faster we travel, the slower our clock ticks. So we can get to places that are farther away in a slower amount of time, but everybody back on Earth is going to experience life at a faster rate compared to us. So we may be able to get from one place to another eventually with better technology, but we wouldn't be able to share much of what we find back home.
It's like the Planet of the Apes, mm-hmm. Charlton
yeah.
Heston.
Yeah.
And you still couldn't exceed the speed of light.
Right.
Valerie's talking
right.
about getting to just under the speed of light, which is theoretically possible, maybe if we have the technology, and then all of that would hold true. You'd get back to Earth, and a year would have passed for you, but 50,000 years would have passed back on Earth, and you'd there'd not likely be a welcoming party waiting for you.
Okay. This one's from Heather and Olive Bridge, and good luck, panel.
Oh, boy.
Origins of the universe. What if time is cyclical, and the universe had a big bang, expands, reaches a maximum expansion, then contracts to a point, then big bangs and expands, then eventually contracts again. And that's from Heather in Olive Bridge.
Well, that is one of the theories of the universe. So it's not as crazy as it sounds to postulate that. But our observations of the early universe don't support that theory. The further back we look and, you know, the speed with which we're moving and all of that suggests that we are not on that path that is eventually going to contract the universe and have a second Big Bang. It doesn't say that, you know, other universes aren't experiencing a Big Bang and being created around us, but ours appears to be kind of an infinitely growing and expanding universe.
Right. That was actually a prevailing thought back as recently as the early 90s. Mm-hmm. It's called the oscillating universe. And back then we thought that the universe must be, it's expanding, but it's slowing its expansion. We were all trying to find the degree that we were slowing down. We knew we had to be slowing down because
right,
everything's
gravity.
Pulling on everything else gravitationally. It was called the deceleration parameter, and it was one of the major hunts in astrophysics. Finding the deceleration parameter, that was thrown out the window in 1998 when we found that instead of slowing down, we're speeding up. So that whole idea of pulsing in and out, maybe like that old Hindu legend of the breaths of Brahma, maybe every 20 billion years there's another breath with new laws of physics each time. It was a wonderful philosophical marriage with science idea that we thought could hold water until the late 90s.
Okay. This one is from Eric, and we only have about a minute left. Eric has a simple question. What is M theory? What is M theory? Anybody know?
We're back to quantum stuff.
Oh, gosh. I am not an expert in M theory at all, so I'm going to pass on that one.
Yeah, generally speaking, at one time not too long ago, every university had essentially a quantum physics almost department because it was so hopeful that we were going to get to the answer to basic fundamental questions about the universe. But as it has failed to come up with anything, any testable theory, any answers to anything, more and more physicists have been abandoning M theory, which is almost synonymous with quantum theory, and slowly it's being let go. We had
probably
a lot of excitement about it, but it's not giving us anything.
No, I feel better not knowing too much about it then.
Yeah.
You know, I feel pretty awful because I think I understood the lowest percentage of the astronomy show that I ever have before.
Aww.
So either I'm getting dumber or you're getting very much smarter. Hey, Val, how's everything going over at Oneonta?
Oh, it's going fantastic. We've got new planetarium shows coming up, a big event next Friday, a speaker about James Webb. So people should take a look on our website for more info.
Very good. And Bob, if people want to find out and trek up with you to a mysterious location up in Alaska or wherever you go, how do they find you on the web?
Bob Berman Tours or Bob Berman Astronomy Tours. That'll take you to the real place that runs it.
Fair enough. Support comes from Taste New York Market at the Capital Region Welcome Center. New York State Foods, Gifts, Coffee, 7 days, 7 to 7. Restrooms north of Thruway Exit 21B, taste.ny.gov. Mass Mocha presenting the Fresh Grass Festival September 23rd through 25th with Tanya Tucker, Taj Mahal, Trampled by Turtles at more, massmocha.org/WAMC. And Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. AGstewardship.org. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for stopping by today. We'll do it again next month. My brain should be cleared of the fog by then, and we'll have another fine show with our guests. Thanks to Zach Malloy. Thanks to, he's our engineer. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's a Food Friday. It's an idea whose time has come. A show devoted to mac and cheese. Deanna Fox and Jelena Bridgham will be here with us tomorrow at 2. Oh, yeah, we're going to carb up tomorrow. We'll see you then.